Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. All right, we're going to start off with some emails because we had one from Tim in Nebraska. And I think Tim is actually a first-time emailer, so I always love when I see someone joining the crew. Hi, Tim. This was sent last week. The subject is pressure on doctors. When I read stories like this, he gives me a link, which I will describe to you, but it's talking about how there's sort of at the administrative level of Australia, a health minister who's making a bunch of very, very negative comments about how terrible ivermectin is, and how that really isn't necessarily true. That's the tone of the article. And of course, there was a little bit of a segment on, I believe, last week's show about Dr. Fauci's comments on ivermectin. And to continue, Tim says, it makes me long for the days when you could speak openly on all medical subjects like you did pre-COVID. To me, it's a sorry state of affairs that doctors can't look out for their patients without pharmacists and politicians telling them what to do. The thing that scares me is how this is being handled. The next pandemic is going to be so much worse with everything that is happening now. To me, the playbook for COVID has already been written and everyone is just being made to take the correct position. He includes a New York Times article about several vaccine regulators who resigned last week. And this came out, August 31st, so maybe 2 weeks ago, the resignation. And what they said was two of the top vaccine regulators are leaving the FDA, resigning over in protest over the push for booster the vaccines. Now, it actually isn't clear whether the two doctors, Dr. Gruber and Dr. Krauss, actually said why they were resigning. So I have to say this looks like it's a little bit of scuttlebutt and inference. But let's not get into the political and bureaucratic details here. Even if it's true that that's why people resigned or the reason they gave, there's a lot of reasons to get out of Dodge on vaccine regulation right now. I don't know if they mentioned the death threats that vaccine regulators and public health officers have been getting, the threats to their family, their safety, the fact that our own county public health officer had to have a police guard for a while after some death threats. You know, if I started getting death threats for practicing medicine to the best of my ability, yeah, I might consider finding a teaching gig. You know, there's only so much martyrdom. I mean, I'm prepared to risk my life to take care of sick people, but I don't know that I'm prepared to risk my life because somebody actually wants to kill me for taking care of sick people. I'd have to give that matter some thoughts. But let's move back to the first point that Tim wants to talk about. What's going on here with ivermectin? I think you've all heard about it, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. But I do want to call out a few false flags, so to speak. And one of them is talking about ivermectin as this proven safe drug that's given all over the planet, everywhere. Tons of people take it all the time. And that's just not true. Okay. Now, part of that statement is true. It is taken all over Africa and other tropical countries because it's very effective against nematodes and parasites, which abound in tropical countries. And some of these diseases, you want to hear about some nasty diseases, look up onchocerciasis, which is actually the thing that ivermectin is approved for. And this is a really nasty parasite, and this drug is really effective at suppressing it. So effective, in fact, that you only need to take your dose once a year. I want to point out that the dose that is being taken is 150 micrograms per kilogram once a year. That works out for a 70-kilogram man to about 10 milligrams once a year. And here's the thing that as a doctor makes me nervous. Well, there's two things, but let's start with the one that really makes me nervous. The half-life of ivermectin is up to 36 hours, which means In older people, it might be 72 hours. It also means that there will be people who don't break it down rapidly at all. And in them, the half-life might be 2 weeks. Also, active metabolites last 3 days. And some of those active metabolites, that means that they're actually still working. So now let's double the time. Let's make it 72 hours or 96 hours while we've still got active drug doing stuff and needing to be broken down further by the liver, which may or may not be up to the task of doing that. And let's talk about that safety profile. Yeah, safe given once a year. Well, there's plenty of time for the liver to deal with the backlog of the accumulation when you give it once a year. Now, when you start taking it daily for 5 days because you're treating COVID, most people are probably going to be fine. It'll have to be given to a whole lot of people because it's only going to be 1 in 10,000 who gets trashed by it. But 1 in 10,000 is still a substantial number because that's sure a lot less. Let's put it this way. The number of people who don't get trashed because they got the COVID vaccine is way more than the number of people who would benefit from ivermectin. And we don't know how many people won't benefit and who will have a side effect. But we can guess that it's going to be something greater than the side effects that we're seeing with the vaccinations, which are not great, not huge. It's used for pinworms in the first world. And I have an article here that came out. This is from the American Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. And by the way, this article comes before COVID. It's published in 2018. Nobody's got a hobby horse on ivermectin here. And this is a large-scale study, and it says, serious neurological events have been reported from large-scale community-based ivermectin treatment campaigns, and the mechanism's been affected. So they wanted to look into it. They looked for serious adverse events, and some of these serious adverse events, seizures was the big one they saw here, but the more common, less serious side effects of ivermectin, eye pain, vision problems, skin rash, itching, confusion, mental status changes, balance problems, trouble walking, stomach pain, fever. Does this start to sound like something you want to give grandma? No, it doesn't. And I'm, you know, grandma age at this point. I wouldn't want to be taking something if I could find a better solution twice a week forever with the idea for the next 2 years isn't going to bioaccumulate because there's no evidence, no data whatsoever on taking this stuff daily for 5 days, let alone taking it twice a week for years. And I do worry that this will injure people kind of along the way that some of the hydroxychloroquine misuse injured people who just didn't know really what they were doing. So it's established. And this study I liked because it was from Europe. Tim also sent me a study that was showing how effective ivermectin was. And this study had a lot of bad research, sort of when you look at how double-blind, was it double-blinded? Was it open label? Was it placebo-controlled? What did they do? How long did they do it? Essentially, it's all over the third world, Iran, Mexico, Egypt, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India. But sorry, India, you're not really third world. But nothing from Europe, nothing from the USA, nothing from Canada. So that worries me a little bit because the ascertainment and the follow through on that may not be as good, particularly if for cases that are being treated as outpatients. You may not know whether there was a seizure. They may not have come back to your hospital. And those areas don't have the sophisticated data system to analyze the side effects. You know, Sweden, yeah, they do. And what they showed was serious neurological effects after the small doses of 200 micrograms given once. It could take up to 7 days, sometimes as quickly as a day. What they saw, unable to walk, disturbed consciousness, depressed consciousness, loss of consciousness, seizure, convulsion, encephalopathy, coma, and tremor. So let's assume that the research that was moderately acceptable to these people who did their meta-analysis, let's even assume that ivermectin is helpful for COVID. Let's assume that that data is good. If you get COVID and you take the appropriate doses, which is like 200 micrograms per kilogram twice a day for 5 days, you will have a better outcome. I can completely buy that. What I can't buy is for prevention as a substitute for a vaccine. It is most definitely not a safer, a proven, effective substitute for vaccination. It just isn't. And yeah, I agree that the government's coming pretty down hard on its use, because I think part of the problem is the public has indisputably made it clear to us that they can't talk intelligently, that they're binary now, that you're either with us or you're against us. And if you're against us, I'm going to key your car and threaten your children. We've gone insane, and you can't have a rational dialogue in an insane situation. So I do my best, and that's my take on ivermectin. Thank you, Tim, for the question. And I think that'll be the last word on that for a while, unless something really earth-shattering comes out. Okay, Annie in Arizona writes, supplements for painful arthritis. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm a longtime listener and love your show. I'm a healthy 70-year-old with significant arthritis of my knees, hips, and hands. I have a lot of pain in my hands, especially as I've been gardening for years, and I would like to continue. I'm currently taking one capsule four times a day of a turmeric blend of 500 milligrams of turmeric root powder and a standardized extract with a total curcuminoids of 50 milligrams with a total curcuminoids of 475. By the way, the numbers don't work here, so I'm not quite sure what she's actually taking, because if you're taking 500 milligrams of turmeric root powder, you absolutely cannot have 475 milligrams of curcuminoids in there, because the amount of curcuminoids in turmeric is about 10%. So I think somebody dropped a decimal place somewhere in typing this, but this is what the battle says. I also take four capsules a day of omega-3 rich fatty fish oil from Trader Joe's, a total of 400 milligrams EPA and 200 milligrams of DHA. Am I taking the right amounts based on the bottle information? I do know that when I cut out gluten completely a number of years ago, my pain got better. Any other suggestions would be very useful. Thanks for your service. So I think the curcuminoid dose is too low. I give people 750 milligrams of curcuminoids daily. I think if you're going to want to try to do it with turmeric root, you're going to need 5 grams, about a teaspoon and a half of root, fresh dried root, and you're going to need about a quarter teaspoon of ground black pepper mixed up with that. And you could put that in capsules, because that's a lot. That's a lot of turmeric to figure out how to fit into your diet. I'm sure you could manage it. If you like that taste, maybe make turmeric butter or something like that and spread it on toast. I'm trying to figure out how you could possibly eat that much and make it tasty. But you could play around and try. It would be way cheaper than the 750 milligrams a day of curcuminoids, because that stuff adds up to about $1 a pill. And I'm guessing you may be on a fixed income and at 70 and would like not to spend too much money. I've got a cheaper way for you to get your 2,000 milligrams of EPA DHA. You're currently getting about 600, so you'd need to triple the amount of your Trader Joe's capsules. That's 12 capsules a day. That's getting crazy. Learn to love sardines. Maybe you could make that turmeric butter and put it on a piece of toast and put a can of sardines on top and grill it or something and make something that you could eat that would be palatable. And that would be cheap. Sardines are a very inexpensive source of omega-3s, and you can get that 2,000 of EPA and DHA that you need, that I recommend for people with hypertension, diabetes, inflammatory diseases like arthritis. You can get that from eating a can of sardines a day, and that's probably the cheapest and most effective solution if you can manage a way to do it. Diane from Seaside writes, we ran into an article about belly fat and avocados. Basically, it says they should help redistribute belly fat in women towards a healthier profile. The references at the bottom say daily consumption of one fresh Haas avocado changed abdominal adiposity distribution among females, but did not facilitate improvements in peripheral insulin sensitivity or beta cell function among adults with overweight and obesity. So that was the conclusion of the abstract of the article. I went and grabbed the article, and thank you, England, because England doesn't have a paywall on academic research. They're like, you know, this was funded by the government, most of this research is. The journals are, in the UK anyway, funded by the government. And so they don't have a paywall. They make their money in different ways. So they don't have to force researchers like myself, who are not affiliated with an institution, to kick them $35 an article, which, by the way, I cannot do. So I'm always happy when I can get the full article and look at it. Now, nutrient comparison, what they did in this study is quite nice. They gave people a meal. This was done at several centers, but it was funded by the Avocado Board. So there is a little skin in the game here. You always want to look at, see who funded the study. And they used a pretty decent method. They had one meal a day with an avocado in it, and they put it in various kinds of recipe. There was a penne pasta, a Spanish rice, a turkey wrap, an egg scramble. They all had an avocado in there, but there was some variety. And the people came and they picked up their meals in a cooler and then heated them up in the microwave. And then they monitored their population of individuals. What they found was that that really didn't change the glucose tolerance test, although there was a trend in the direction of doing better. It did not reach statistical significance. But what they did find was that the abdominal adiposity, what we like to call in functional medicine the gut-to-butt ratio, got better in people who used the avocado than in people who didn't. And that gut-to-butt ratio reached the level of statistical significance in the women, but not in the men. And that also just has to do with women do tend to carry their belly fat a little further. Now, as I look at the study, what I'll see is who was lost to follow-up. And just to give you a little science lesson here, when you have a placebo group and you have a treatment group, and half the treatment group drops out, then it's hard to draw conclusions. If there's side effects and people drop out, or they drop out because for whatever reason, maybe they don't have energy anymore to come for the study, it really weakens the statistics. You need to graduate with hopefully the same number of people as you started with. But if you don't, the dropout rates have to be the same across both groups in order for it to really be good science. And in this case, it was decent, and they did match for that. So what I think we can say is that MUFA, which is monounsaturated fats, that's what's in avocados, are way better for you than saturated fats. And I will say that the study made a point of keeping the actual carbohydrate content the same. So we did not see a difference in diabetes. But I will tell you, most of the time, if you switch over to healthy fats, you're going to eat fewer carbohydrates. And you will see an improvement in diabetes or prediabetes. And if you see a drop in the insulin levels, because the person's, they're not hungry and they don't snack and grab a cracker or a cookie or the things that are sort of scattered around our environment. So they don't grab that cookie, so they don't get the little insulin burst from it. So you do see, with a higher fat diet, an improvement in insulin resistance that's probably just related to fewer insulin spikes over the period of time of the study. So I am actually all about a diet that is high in healthy fat, and I encourage people. I wouldn't look at avocados as a weight loss tool. I would look at them as a satiety tool, understanding that you can still blow it if you have compulsions and you need to modify your environment and make sure that the cookies are, you know, put away, maybe down in the basement or something, and not right there on the counter. Little behavioral things like that go a long way to helping with weight loss. So I have to tell you about an old TV show that I used to watch when I was a kid called The $6 Million Man. My friends, fast forward to the 21st century, and we are there. I saw a video just a couple of nights ago about a bionic arm that actually plugs in to the nerves, not some kind of weird, you know, spinal interface, but the researchers are able to just get into the nerve to the foot and talk to it in a way that the brain is able to interpret as sensation. They showed us a man walking, and they showed us a guy cracking an egg using a bionic sensor. And it was just astonishing. In one case, the person had been trained. And so once it was plugged in, they knew what was going on. In the other, the person was naive. They hadn't been trained. And they used a surface interface right over the nerve. It responded across the skin. And the person was able to make the arms work and make the fingers work. And they felt the feedback. We talked about that bionic hand a few shows ago. Well, this is all great. And now researchers have established that they can scatter tiny sensors, which they've just basically developed literally in this last year, all over the surface of the brain in experimental animals that will allow them to read the brainwaves and brain activity and furthermore stimulate brain activities. They're calling these sensors neurograins. Instead of having like a little nail bed that's stuck into a part of the brain, which is how all of this brain research has been done up until this moment, they're using these little tiny grains like a sesame seed and dropping them onto the surface of the brain where they actually use a wireless signal to talk to a sensor patch on the scalp. So it's not the terminal man anymore. It's not the work that I did after my undergraduate where I was implanting electrodes into the pain center of mice trying to release endorphins and reduce pain in these rodents. So the idea that we might be able to have pain caps for people with chronic pain and get around the opiate piece, because you all know that story and why we wanted to try to get around that. There was a science fiction story at the same time about using this sort of technology to treat seizures. A book called The Terminal Man. They made it into a movie, but it's much better as a book, as Michael Crichton stories usually are. Anyway, getting back to this, we're now at the stage where I could absolutely see us doing this, not just on people who have paralysis or other issues, people who have seizures, to have a vagal nerve stimulator for Parkinson's disease, or maybe a stimulator that increases activity in the amygdala for Alzheimer's disease, but being able to measure where the brain activity is and relay that to a sensor, which presumably with sufficient machine learning and AI circuitry could eventually send back signals to modulate brain activity, possibly starting seizures before they even get started. That's just one of the myriad potential activities here. And because it's just little seeds sitting on the surface of the brain, they'd be fairly easily placed in a relatively non-invasive way, a kind of tiny little drill hole, and drop it down onto the dura. It would probably work from the dura, and so it would feel it through the brain membranes. That would drastically lower the risk of infection. We take an important step here to being able, for example, why are we sending astronauts to Mars? Why don't we just have the astronauts in orbit around Mars talking via Wi-Fi to robots that wander around on the surface of Mars and do all of the research, and for that matter, build the habitats that if we ever want to put people on another planet, we're going to need. This also works for driving miners on asteroids. I've always loved science fiction. There are always so many barriers in the way to visualizing what the future is going to look like. But I'm excited and fascinated by these brain-machine interfaces that are being developed. And yes, like a gun, it points both ways. It could be used for good and it could be used for bad. But the fact that we have the possibility of building it, at least I hope that cooler minds and kinder hearts will prevail and that we will end up with technology that really furthers the human endeavor. So I guess I'm feeling optimistic this week. Dreaming, right? REM sleep. We learned a couple of months ago on this program about how deep sleep caused a neurolymphatic wave that swept garbage and trash through the brain. But on the way out of deep sleep, you have REM sleep. And REM sleep, it turns out, has a very unique property that it increases blood flow in brain capillaries. And this is important for delivering oxygen and nutrients also waste removal, but I think most importantly, you take out the trash and then you bring in the groceries. And that's the appropriate order of operations when you're running a brain. We've often seen how weird, crazy, and stupid we get if we're not allowed to sleep. And it turns out that REM sleep deprivation will actually quite rapidly drive people crazy. They'll start hallucinating. And also, deep sleep deprivation will make people hurt. You can get a sort of fibromyalgia-like syndrome. Fibromyalgia is framed as a brain disease where there's increased pain. Well, maybe it is. Maybe the increased pain is from too much garbage in the brain, causing inflammation and leading to malfunctions. It all fits together. Researchers in Japan have been working using a technique to directly visualize these red blood cells. They used a dye to make the blood vessels visible under fluorescent light, and they studied mice who have very thin scalps, so you could see the brains glow in the dark. That must have been fun. And they were able to look at the mice using essentially brain monitoring similar to what we use for those sleep studies that many of you have had. So we can tell when a person's in REM sleep, non-REM sleep, and awake, or a mouse. And they correlated that during REM sleep, and this was quite surprising, this is the first time this has been reported, there was a massive increased flow of red blood cells through the brain capillaries, but there was no difference between non-REM sleep and the awake state. So REM is really unique here. They then used some kind of interrupter. They disrupted the mice whenever they got into REM, and what they found was that if you were REM deprived, when you did get a chance, the blood flow during the rebound REM was much greater. So there really was an important REM quantity to blood flow, a certain amount. The brain was trying to make up for it. They then used mice who had been genetically engineered not to have the adenosine A2A receptor. Now that's the receptor that you block when you drink caffeine. So caffeine blocks that A2A receptor, and that A2A receptor makes you sleepy. So if you take the caffeine, you block it. In these mice, they were engineered genetically not to have it. Drowsy mice, I guess. And what they saw was that during REM sleep, they did not get much of an increase in their blood flow. And even rebound REM sleep, they didn't get anything like the vigorous increase in blood flow. So this directly, semi-directly, says that these adenosine A2A receptors are responsible for the actual changes in brain flow during sleep. Now, we know that a little bit of caffeine really helps performance. That adenosine A2A suppression from a little coffee really helps you with your decision-making, your test-taking, and your general cognitive functioning, including your math. That's been known for a long time. But as you might expect, as it usually is the case with the body, too much of a good thing is not better. In fact, too much excitation makes you stupid and undecisive. And I want to segue, before I talk about this brain research, to a book I read last year about something called polyvagal theory. This is the idea that we actually have three neurological states. We have the fight or flight and the rest and digest, but we have a third state that the vagal nerve is responsible. That's the freeze and play dead. So the freeze and play dead, we see that in rabbits, we see it in possums, deer in the headlights, right? Why is the deer not running? The deer is so afraid it can't decide what to do. How that happened and whether it has to do with the vagus nerve or not was something that was always in my mind a little bit when I read about this theory. It may not necessarily be the vagus nerve, but there is an interesting mechanism that scientists doing brain research have unraveled that I'm going to tell you about now. The two main places where the brain makes decisions contain neurons that are actually switchable. And one of the things that switches them is the body's internal dynamics. So when a person is excited and their heart rate goes up, they have a harder time initially, a little bit of arousal. They actually, as we said with the coffee, are able to do fairly well. But if you make the arousal stronger, some interesting things happen in the brain. by the time the blood pressure starts to rise and the person starts to breathe a bit more rapidly, that's when the bad decisions are going to get made. That's when the indecision is going to happen. That indicates too much arousal for the brain to be working on all cylinders. And we see, among other things, a decrease in activity in the executive function part of the brain and an increase of activity in the emotional part of the brain. So it's like we drop from human brain to cat brain. And sorry, cat owners, but cats definitely have this sort of bimodal, I'm in fight or flight, hissing and fighting and running, or I'm relaxed and cool and purring. So if we think about dropping into that binary state of the brain, I think we come close to what's going on here. The interesting thing is that the same neuron will behave differently when our heartbeat increases. And what these researchers were able to show looking at three rhesus monkeys is that the orbital frontal cortex and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex had about 18 to 20% of the neurons in each area correlated with fluctuations in the heart rate. So when the heart rate was high, the activity of these cells would actually go either up or down. And when it went down, the neurons disappeared from decision-making. So the decision-making was impaired, and it took longer to make those decisions. So it's almost as if the neurons were hijacked by arousal or turned off by arousal. And this is what we see. So again, how can you turn this around when you start to feel this? And the most effective way is deep breathing. So when you start to feel yourself breathing shallowly and your heart speeding up, that's the moment where you want to put your hand on your diaphragm and you want to breathe in to the count of 5 seconds, really slowly. If you have to do it through puckered lips or do it through your nose, it doesn't matter. That's like, you know, graduate school level of breathing, but just getting yourself to slow down. 5 seconds in, pause. 5 seconds out, pause. 5 seconds in, pause. Just doing that for a minute will shift your decision making and you'll make wiser decisions. You may decide that that snappy comeback that was on the tip of your tongue would be better left unsaid. You may decide that storming out of the room or punching the guy or breaking the dish or whatever it was that you were about to do might not be the right move. You may decide that storming the Capitol building is a bad idea and you should probably stay outside and back away slowly. You may decide that those troll responses that you were about to throw out into social media are best left unsaid. So my advice is breathe before you tweet, breathe before you act. And as we like to say in medicine, in a code blue, first check your own pulse. We're moving in from the brain and brain interfaces. We're moving into brain diagnostics and a couple of stories now about Alzheimer's. Most of us know that amyloid plaques are protein deposits that collect in the brain. They're considered a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease, although, to be fair, they are found in the brains of people who show no signs of Alzheimer's, so they aren't the whole story. But we also see amyloid plaques in the retina of the eye, which sort of makes sense because the retina is an extension of the brain. It's an extension of the optic nerve that's just gotten very big and turned into an umbrella and is a big balloon of nerve at the end of the optic nerve that allows us to sense light. It's a specialized nerve. So a study done at UCSD School of Medicine, that's in San Diego, looked at retinal and brain amyloids in patients from a study called the A4 study, and a second study, that looks at amyloid risk and neurodegeneration. What they found was that retinal scanning seemed to be very effective in identifying people who had preclinical Alzheimer's. They used a monoclonal antibody called solanezumab to improve the retinal imaging. And the thought is that we may be able to give people an injection and then use just a simple slit lamp and a camera to look in the back of their eyeballs, just like when you get your eyes checked and the doctor does that as part of your screening, looking for retinal tears, this would be looking for retinal amyloid and quantifying it and using it as an indicator for Alzheimer's disease. So it would be helpful, really helpful, to be able to assess, is this caused by that or is it some other form of dementia that might have different treatments? This second study, also published this last week, comes out of Nigeria. And researchers state that they have developed a deep learning-based method that can predict possible onset of Alzheimer's from brain images with about 99% accuracy. What they did in this study was differentiate between mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease. With functional MRI, we can do that. One of the things that's done the most right now is a test called NeuroQuant, where you look at the size of the amygdala. But functional MRI looks at activity, not just size, and requires an injection of a radioactive glucose substance. So this is not in diagnostic use. This is still in research use. But the idea is we've got plenty of images of functional MRI. You can see the correlations, but it's like mammograms. You know, having a machine overread the mammogram and highlight areas that look a little funny so that the actual radiologist studies those areas more carefully is exactly what we want AI to do. We want deep learning and AI methods to improve the accuracy, not make the decision itself, but act as an assistant to make sure that the areas of concern based on an algorithm are true and have a doctor supervise that and say, yes, that looks right, or no, that looks like an error. They were able, knowing what people had, what their diagnosis was, the AI was in the 99% in terms of accuracy. Now, the question I was asking as I was reading this was, it's cool science, but why are we doing this? This research is predicated on the idea that we have effective therapy and intervention strategies for Alzheimer's. We have no drugs that work. That recent drug that was approved by the FDA was approved over a majority of the review board saying, no, we don't want it approved. It's not good enough and it has too many side effects. They still went ahead and approved the drug. So back to Tim at the beginning of this program, yes, I think the government is making decisions that are not in line with science. I think that is demonstrably true. What we do need to be doing is different science on Alzheimer's. And I'll just tell you that the reason we have no drugs is because we develop the drugs on mice, and mice don't get Alzheimer's. We have an Alzheimer's model. The problem is the model is a mouse with mutant amyloid who develops plaques. But the vast majority of people with Alzheimer's don't have mutant amyloid. They have normal amyloid. They just develop the plaques for reasons we don't understand. The entire field of Alzheimer's drug research is based on a false premise. What isn't based on a false premise is research in humans. And if you haven't read it, or at least looked at the Cliff's Note version of it, look up Dale Bredesen and his work, Bredesen. You could start with Wikipedia and branch out from there. He has a very good book where he presents a hypothesis and a treatment intervention and results of that treatment intervention, which is what we call science and the scientific method. His work over the last few decades has focused on this disease and shows evidence for the case that there are multiple lifestyle interventions that we can do that make a huge difference in the progression of Alzheimer's, and chiefly among them, quite germane to the topics of this program, sleep. Getting good quality deep sleep and enough of it is a huge piece of preventing Alzheimer's. And it makes sense, because what is amyloid plaque but trash? And what is sleep, as we've just talked about in these two studies, what is sleep but taking out the trash? So yeah, take out the trash. What else? Well, there's lots of work that shows that exercise helps build new brain cells, new synapses. It helps new synapses form, which means permanent learning, not that forgetfulness, which is a part of cognitive damage. So here we are. a look at the science. Reducing inflammation, controlling diabetes, exercise, sleep. Those are basically the four pillars of wisdom and the persistence of wisdom. And what would a Dr. Don show be without at least one discussion of the microbiome? In recent years, rather than talking about the microbiome as a whole, some research teams have been drilling down to identify specific microbes, mapping out the complex and sometimes very surprising pathways that connect them to the brain. That's what allows causal attributions to be made, say researchers. Preliminary work in humans and lots of studies in mice suggests that microbes can trigger or alter the course of conditions such as Parkinson's disease, autism, and more. So if we tweak the microbiome, could we prevent or treat these diseases? Well, there are already some human trials going on, and it's very, very interesting. Specific things are emerging. So let's talk about Parkinson's disease. There's a certain strain of E. coli in the brain that makes a protein called Curli, C-U-R-L-I. And this is almost like a prion. This Curli protein can prompt other proteins, including one that we make called alpha-synuclein, to misfold. You know what you find in the brains of Parkinson's patients? Lots and lots of misfolded alpha-synuclein. Studies going retrospective have shown that it shows up, this misfolded protein, in the gut about 10 years before the first Parkinson's symptoms show up. So the error goes up to the brain, and this protein increases. Literally, the gut makes the protein. Bacteria in the gut make the protein. That protein causes the synuclein to form in the brain, to be increased in the brain. We also know that there's a bacteria called Akkermansia muciniphilia. This is an anti-inflammatory bacteria, but if too much of it will eat all your mucus and give you a leaky gut. So that one can run away from you if you're not careful. You want it just right, Goldilocks style. It makes a molecule, however, called nicotinamide. That's vitamin B3, and that also heads up the vagus nerve to the brain and has been shown to improve symptoms of motor neuron disease in mouse models. In the gut, there are also bacteria called segmentous filamentous bacteria. And when you have those in your gut, it prompts the immune system to stimulate T helper 17 cells. These produce a cytokine called IL-17 in the gut. This cytokine travels through the lymph into the bloodstream, because it's so small, it's just a protein. It gets into the placenta, and it reaches the brain of the developing fetus. And when it gets there, it causes the babies, when they're born, to behave like they were autistic. In maternal gut infection may be fundamental in developing, affecting brain development and possibly leading to autism. One of the things in functional medicine we do know is that there's a very strong link between dysbiosis, that is to say unusual, large quantities of unusual organisms overgrowing the beneficial ones in the intestines in children with autism. And we have empirical but not double-blind placebo-controlled data showing that when you do the basic microbiome reboot and help that, that the parents report that the children respond. Now, there's absolutely no way to do this in a placebo-blinded fashion, and it could be wishful thinking on the part of the parents. Absolutely true. But I'm thinking that what would be nice would be if someone did biomarkers on kids who are undergoing this and looked for evidence that IL-17 levels were dropping in the bloodstream and that correlated with behavioral improvement, which could be scored by an independent observer. So, yeah, let's throw some money at this. Well, why would we throw money at it? There's nothing to patent here. Oh, well, we'll have to wait till somebody develops a drug, and then maybe someone will do some research to show that this is a thing. Now, you probably all know that ulcers can be caused by a bacteria, but back in the 70s, we didn't know that. We thought ulcers were caused by too much stomach acid. so that we used to do a surgery called vagotomy, where we would cut the connection between the brain and the vagus nerve. Strange side effect of something we did for the wrong reasons that kind of worked, but really was quite disabling in the long run. Those people got anemia and osteoporosis because you need that stomach acid to absorb nutrients. But they got a lower risk of Parkinson's disease because there wasn't any way for the alpha-synuclein from the E. coli to climb up into the brain. So it actually reduced the risk of Alzheimer's. Somebody noticed this and went back later on and injected the alpha-synuclein into the gut in mice, and they found it in the brain. But if they first cut the vagus nerve, then the alpha-synuclein did not show up in the brain. It stayed in the gut. So this is in mice, but I really feel like Parkinson's is looking like a prion disease. It's looking like a protein misfolding caused by a contagious pattern, a protein that causes other proteins to misfold, just like Jakob Creutzfeldt disease and Kuru. And in this case, the protein is coming from a bacteria. So, wow, the data is really emerging that the gut health and the brain health are tightly linked. We talked a little bit about the nicotinamide already, and they also saw that this was very beneficial in mice who developed ALS. That's Lou Gehrig's disease. So when they looked at the microbiomes of humans with ALS and those of their unaffected family members, they saw less nicotinamide in the individuals with ALS. And remember, that's what the Akkermansia makes. So maybe we could be giving B3 to people with a family history of ALS. What would happen if it was early? Would we be able to stop this horrible degenerative disease quickly enough? So more and more, as we start looking, we start to think, this mouse and rat work is really, really driving the idea that we can make a huge difference. The autism mice, another study looking at autism, mice were housed separately. They were created experimentally. And when they housed them with other mice who were neurotypical, they ate their poop. They ate the poop of, and mice eat each other's poop. And so if they got a hold of healthy poop and ate it, they actually improved. They found that the missing bacteria was Lactobacillus reuteri, one of the lactobacilli, and it worked. They gave it to other mouse models for ALS, and it was able to reverse some of the behaviors. So, by the way, if you cut the vagus nerve, it didn't work. So there's a whole lot of action going on down there that we need to be thinking about, researching. And in the meantime, eat lots of fiber, eat lots of vegetables, don't eat stuff that's got antibiotics in it, take some probiotics or eat some fermented food, and maybe that'll turn out to be a really smart move. It's looking like that's what you should be investing in right now. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.